the boom and the bust cycles are part of startup and innovation and technology. People need to think about this as a feature and not a bug. The reality is, if you look at the data, the vast majority of startups will fail. And that is a feature. We want people to try more things because we don't know what's going to work. The point of innovation is that you have a hypothesis that something could work. You try it. 7, 8, 9 times out of 10, it is not going to work. But that doesn't mean no value was created along the way. Some intellectual property was created. People learned a bunch of stuff along the way, and there was value created.
Welcome to Brave. Learn from Southeast Asia's best tech leaders. Build the future, learn from our past, and stay human in between. No BS on success. I'm Jeremy Au, venture capitalist, Sierra founder, Harvard MBA, science fiction nerd, and dad of two daughters. Every week, we debate startup news, interview changemakers, answer listener questions, and share personal insights. Join our movement of over 40,000 members and get transcripts, resources, and community at www.bravesea.com. Stay well and stay brave. HD Mall is a healthcare marketplace in Southeast Asia, connecting patients to over 1,800 medical providers. This covers multiple categories, such as dental, aesthetics, and elective surgeries. Over 300,000 patients have accessed more affordable healthcare via HD Mall. Get yourself a well-deserved health checkup. If you're in Thailand, go to hdmall.co.th. If you're in Indonesia, go to hdmall.id.
Morning, Shiyan.
Morning, Jeremy. How's it going?
Good. Well, you know, we want to talk about three big companies today, if we can get to all of it. Obviously, the big ones would be TikTok, ByteDance, potential ban, which is also quite linked to ShopBack and the recent layoffs. And thirdly, you know, there's a recent headline that came out, which was, is Grab too big to fail? So we can see what we can touch on and see what we can go for. But let's talk about TikTok first, since everybody uses it. Well, to commemorate the US potential ban, I started using TikTok again just to kind of like feel. And I think the first video that came up was some sort of US representative house. He is very popular on TikTok. And then he apologized for voting for the ban of TikTok. So it's quite interesting because, again, he's on TikTok. He's popular on TikTok. He's got millions of views. And, you know, obviously.
Well, so I guess it's not so much a ban as the forced sale, right?
Ooh, this is really interesting. Yeah. So it is effectively a divestment or nationalization bill, which is, I'm starting to get more comfortable with nationalization, which is the US government wants to nationalize the TikTok US operations by forcing them to sell to a US acquirer, right? US data centers. So, which is interesting.
Yeah. I mean, I don't know. I know people are putting together consortiums to bid, right? Steve Mnuchin is putting together a bid and all these various other folks are trying to bid on it. And I don't know. I just don't know whether this thing is going to pass.
Well, yeah. I mean, first of all, I don't think China is going to allow TikTok to be sold to a US side because he effectively created a competitor to ByteDance. That's one. Two is China has also local laws that allow it to prevent the sale. So algorithms is now one of those protected technologies. So effectively, they have an equivalent of the US side. So, you know, even if TikTok wants to sell itself, I think the Chinese government may just be like, no, you're not allowed to sell. So this market. And I think there's a little bit of a game of chicken as a result, right? Because I think the US government would be best served, like you said, by a nationalization of TikTok under US by, and then everybody continues to use TikTok, you know, your teenagers and young adults. But I think if TikTok is really forced to be banned or is not allowed to be sold by the Chinese, you know, but a blame game, but I think removing TikTok from 100 million Americans is going to be electorally unpleasant for, I think, President Biden.
Well, you just kick the can down the road, right? Till after the election to deal with it.
I think that's the optimal strategy is, I think, wait for after the election to deal with it and just keep quiet about it. So I don't think the sale will happen or the nationalization attempt will happen before. It's just too scary. I mean, like the last election was like 40,000 votes between Trump and Biden, right, across the swing states. And there's 100 million people using TikTok, you know. 40,000 votes is quite swingable if people feel like their TikTok got taken away, right?
I don't know. The research on social media just continues to pile up on being like pretty detrimental to teenage brains and mental Ooh. Health. And so, I mean, this is a bit tangential to the, you know, national ownership question, but just as an addictive good that is probably not good for young people, maybe it would be better for people to take it away from, you know, 100 million Americans. But it's your right. It's our freedom to choose how we want to assault our brains. brains. You know, God forbid that anyone should advise us differently.
I mean, it goes back to what your previous stance was in the previous episode that we had, that we'll link to it. But you were advocating for more across the field industry regulations, for example, on parental locks or guidance or restrictions, right? Similar to, I think, the Chinese have restricted the amount of time that people can use, you know, gaming apps. They regulated away the use of a lot of gamification or gambling-like mechanics in various games. And they require age verification ID, right, in China to...
Yeah, but I mean, I'll set the article up, but there was a recent article that did a lot of research on this, which is it's not just the social media itself that damaging. It is also the opportunity cost. It's what you're not doing when you're just down the social media rabbit hole. You're not engaging with other people. You're not developing your social skills. You're not moving your body. You're like stationary. And so all those things, the cumulative impact of all those things is actually pretty negative for teenage development. And so I think there is a national interest. Hey, how do you leverage the power of the internet and connection, but also not, I mean, create people who can self-radicalize themselves into thinking they want to commit hate crimes when they're sitting in Singapore. I mean, like, some of it is just insane.
Yeah. We were discussing the story about this secondary school Chinese kid in Singapore who self-radicalized himself into white supremacy. But the thing is, we don't know what platform he used, though. So
yeah, that's what I'm saying. It's an across-the-board regulation question, right? It's not a platform where, you know, they say, hey, you need to go touch grass. I believe that, right? People need to go breathe fresh air.
Touch grass legislation.
Yeah.
Sorry, that's the funniest. It's like we mandate a minimum requirement of going out into nature and going for a walk. Sorry, that's against my rights to watch YouTube.
I actually think... I think people would be much better off if they spent at least an hour outdoors a day.
So funny. No, I agree. Yes, we're both parents, and I think we both would be like, hey, let's have some restrictions on screen time, and we want to use the, like you said, opportunity cost to go do something fun, right? Something like educational.
But it doesn't even have to be educational. I even just think running around interacting with other kids and adults is in and of itself beneficial. It doesn't have to be a structured, like, let's learn how to multiply.
Yeah.
So, but yeah, it's, I don't know. I do think it is very interesting.
I think we're both aligned that in general, if the industry can self-regulate, but if not, we have to regulate.
It cannot. The industry has no capacity to self-regulate. Its incentives are against self-regulation.
That's every industry's incentive is against self-regulation, right? But yeah, I agree with you that across the board, if you're really concerned about social media and its impact on the youth, I think you should have consistent legislation. I just feel like they said...
I just don't think the American Senate is famed for its consistency.
Yeah, I just think they're not going to catch... It's like they say, right? It's like the worst thing for the dog that's chasing a car is to catch the car. So I think you're chasing this TikTok thing. I think they want to force China to divest and ByteDance. And I just don't think China will allow a divestment. Yeah, I think it just exit. So effectively, I think China is giving that signal to say, hey, if you ask us to do this, we're just going to block the sale by ByteDance. ByteDance will just say, hey, I'm just following and made a corporate decision from there. And then what the cost of that is, like I said, I don't think it'll happen before November.
Then we could just brainwash the rest of the world. Forget the Americans. You know, there's 7 billion other people that, you know, except that the ARPU is much lower. So,
yeah, I think that it's a valuable market to give up for the Chinese. I mean, you know, they're making about $120 billion worldwide, and $16 billion of that comes from the US alone. But it's also the advertisers that are in the US market that would find it very difficult to advertise on the platform. So I think it's not just $16 billion in terms of consumption, but more in terms of advertiser revenue. But still, yeah, I just think TikTok will just exit. I mean, they just left India as well. They just said, hey, you know what? India banned it. They just walked out. They just never sold anything.
But it's interesting, right? TikTok is probably the like famous or the one that everyone knows, but there's actually tons of other live media sites that are actually radar and pretty big, share in lots of market. And so I don't know what the authorities' position is going to be. Like, do you just try to ban all of them?
No, I think they're just going to ban / force the divestment of the Chinese one, which is TikTok, right? Like you said, it's an alliance between the conservatism around the concerns around national security, China hawks, social media folks. I don't think it would converge into a broader ban on all international or non-US social media live apps.
I don't know. I don't envy them their position.
Yeah. But actually, this is an interesting conversation. So we don't think it's going to happen before the elections, both of us. It's just not going to happen. But the question is, do you think it's going to happen next year? I mean, after the election? No?
Because nothing changes, right? China does not want to allow the sale. And so then does this topic continue to like, for whoever's trying to push it. I'm not really sure who is winning here. They can all China bash because it seems to be popular with constituents until it really comes to taking things away from constituents. I mean, all of these states that have passed social media bans and stuff, they haven't been effective. Yeah. Are you telling me that no one in the state of Montana is using TikTok? I just don't believe it.
Sorry. It's like, why are you in jail? I'm in jail for murder. I'm in jail for using TikTok. But I think let's talk about it, because right now the US election is 50-50. So it's effectively 50% betting odds on Trump and about 50% on Biden. So it's swinging left and right a little bit, but that's where the current political forecasts are. And it's interesting because I think that if Biden wins, I think there's a good chance he'll just let legislation go through and he'll just sign it as a bipartisan piece of legislation next year. But what's interesting is that Trump has actually come out against this legislation, which is very fascinating.
Because he's not a logical person.
Well, I think there's an electoral logic that he has, which was like, I was for the ban when it was more popular 4 or 5 years ago. And now I am against the ban because 100 million Americans really like TikTok, right? So I think Trump is probably not going to ban TikTok because he realized that everybody enjoys TikTok.
I don't know. I find speculating on US politics to be very unproductive.
Yeah, but I think it's productive if you are like a ByteDance employee or executive, right? Probably every day is, I mean, obviously, you got to handle 90% of your revenue and growth for the rest of the world. But the US side is also, like you said in the past, is an anchor legislation, right? A lot of people look at them for public policy leadership as well. So I feel like it's one of those existential risks that you have to spend a lot of time thinking about. Oh, and then Shouji Chew, you know, basically sent out that message and push notification to every TikTok person saying, you got to lobby your congressman. So it was a super viral. Obviously, it was like a button that was pushed on TikTok HQ. I mean, it was like Uber, right? Uber did it.
Yeah.
FanDuel for the gaming side. Airbnb also did it. Everybody has been activating their user base.
Yeah. I mean, it makes sense. You've got the audience. But I find it hard to believe that there will actually be a sale.
I don't think there'll be a sale for sure. I think it's either exit or stay. I don't think there's a sale. So that was a game of chicken. It would be interesting. What a negotiation parameter, right? I think it's important because there's so many ByteDance employees now in Singapore and Southeast Asia. So
you should do a poll of them. If any of you are listening, free to write in anonymously. Tell us what you really think.
I do have friends who work at TikTok as well in the US as well. So it'd be interesting. It's like every year you're basically under threat of getting banned. It's kind of an existential business continuity risk. Well, talking about other companies that also are going through existential questions, I thought that was a fun piece by Straits Times. And they were talking about the question, provocative question, is Grab too big to fail?
I hate these headlines. I feel like we normally say too big to fail in the context of banks or utilities, things that are actually existential. I don't know if your right to food delivery is in the same bucket, but I guess I'm willing to debate it, Jeremy. Make the case to me. Why is it too big to fail?
Well, the writer, which is Lee Kwok Howe, kind of makes the case that in general, there is a strong market position in food delivery and transportation. It's about the everyday app, the super app. But he does make at the end kind of a very strong counter argument to his own argument, basically saying that he believes that Gojek would be very happily take over the whole system if Grab was forced, you know, exit the market, right? And so I think his argument in conclusion is maybe not. Again, the question is Grab too big to fail, right? If he really thought that Grab was too big to fail, the headline would be Grab is too big to fail. So you make it a question as part of that rhetorical statement. But yeah, I thought it was just a provocative headline.
Yeah, but I mean, like, too big to fail is generally like the cost of them not existing would be so great that it's in the national interest to support them. And I just don't think that's true, which is at least, I mean, I don't know about the region, but from a Singapore perspective, there is ample public transit. The taxi system existed before Grab came. I don't know why they renamed it to Zig, but there is an app. You can call taxis. Food delivery existed before. And I think there's another dynamic, which is like a lot of restaurants actually resent the cut that Grab is taking and the markup. And if there were an alternative, they would use it. You could say Grab actually did the education that in the pandemic, right, to consumers about delivery that more people are now willing to pay for it. It's not as hard probably. Hey, yeah, you can just order from me direct. We won't pay Grab such a big cut. So you'll get a better price and I'll get better profits. You'll get the thing you want, which is food delivery. I don't know that it's that much of a cornered resource. It's not like saying your savings are going to zero because my bank has failed. I think that's like a totally shaking the faith of the financial system. I just think this is like a totally different kettle of fish.
Yeah, I love what you just kind of define, which is that classically, too big to fail has been used for US financial institutions, I would say, and to some extent, global financial institutions. So for example, Credit Suisse and UBS, for example, there. So obviously banks have a multiplier effect with the fact that they're handling loans, they're handling the multiplier effect of the capital piece and so forth. So I think banks have the unique ability to be too big to fail because of the multiplication effect through the financial system and the plumbing. But for a company like Grab or Gojek, honestly, if Grab closed tomorrow for some reason, Gojek would take over immediately. No questions asked. It wouldn't even blink an eye, or vice versa. If Gojek closed tomorrow, Grab will take over immediately. I don't even think there'll be an interruption in service. So I just don't see a ripple effect at all. And I think it's interesting because Grab finally posted a profit of $11 million, right? In the fourth quarter, which is, you know,
great. Like, finally. From the last.
I mean, people are complaining about a cut, but it turns out that that cut of the transaction fee that has been increased over the years, plus obviously its various bets and so forth. I mean, effectively, Grab was subsidizing a lot of different players in the ecosystem for so many years. And now, I think this year, effectively, the fourth quarter, 2023 is the first quarter has ever posted profit. So I don't know. It feels like it's been a net subsidy for many years, I would say, to the ecosystem. But also, I think looking more broadly, the really standardized logistics and travel and food delivery experience. I mean, I don't know, but pre-Grab, you know, it was a real dicey thing to get from point A to point B in Southeast Asia. I mean, Singapore's fine, but it used to be pretty dicey in Indonesia or Vietnam to get from point A to point B. And now with Grab and Gojek.
Don't forget, ta-da.
Ta-da. Why don't you plug Tada? Because I've never gotten the appeal of Tada, which is, I don't know, it feels like not even the black sheep. It's like the orphan kids in the corner. But talk about Tada.
I just think it's an alternative player and it's a decentralized network and there's no sort of platform cut fee. And so there's people who drive for it because they make more per trip. So I don't have a lot of loyalty, right? I check the price and then if it feels high, I cycle through the others. And if all of them feel high, then I take MRT.
Yeah.
I'm not a totally price insensitive consumer, right? I do make decisions based on what they're charging. And so.
It's true. I feel like Tada is, sorry, you might as well add ride to it, right? RYDE as well, just in the Singapore market. But yeah, I think in general, I just don't think Grab is too big to fail. I just saw it as a spicy headline, but it feels like the company has finally hit break even after so many years. And then now we're like jumping on them and be like, oh, it's too big to fail. And we're like, you know.
Well, I mean, it's a subsidy from all the investors, right?
Yeah. To society, right? And I think there's a huge amount of social positive impact that we talked about, again, standardizing or improving the customer experience for so many different verticals like transportation, logistics. I would also say that it's a huge talent piece because I think what we've seen, and I've spoken with some stakeholders in the policy side, but you know, when we looked at the MNCs, kind of like the big tech majors. So a lot of them, when they are expanding the H in Singapore, obviously there's some engineering roles, but a lot of it is like marketing and business, market expansion, engineering teams, and the leadership teams are really based in the US. But, you know, your homegrown domestic champions, I would say like Grab, for example, but you could also make the argument for like Zendit and other kind of like Southeast Asian companies, is that they actually have the leadership team, which is key, but also the engineering team. So there's actually a talent ladder and elevator. And so when there's cutbacks or layoffs, the domestic ones are laying off less in Singapore, but also they are training a stronger generation of executive leadership compared to multinational corporations. What do you think about that point of view?
I think we would have to see the data. I don't know what the mix is on the headcount. So I would have to see the data to sort of opine on that. But I do think that the boom and the bust cycles are part of startup and innovation and technology. It's that, and I think people need to think about this as a feature and not a bug, yeah. Which is the reality is if you look at the data, the vast majority of startups will fail. And that is a feature. We want people to try more things because we don't know what's going to work. Obviously, yeah. If we knew what was going to work, we would do that all day long. But I think the point of innovation is that you have a hypothesis that something could work. You try it. 7, 8, 9 times out of 10, it is not going to work. But that doesn't mean no value was created along the way. It could have been, it doesn't work as a venture scale company. And you had staffed it that way, you'd funded it that way. But then the realization was like, no, it doesn't. So you cut back and you run it as a going concern. Or you thought it could be a standalone business, but actually the thing you developed is more of a feature and not a company and you get sold. But some intellectual property was created. People learned a bunch of stuff along the way and there was value created. And so I think accepting that reality is part of the maturation of this ecosystem, yeah. To say this boom and bust is a normal part of it. Obviously, it is very painful to be laid off. Like, no disputing that. But I think a mark of a really robust ecosystem is these people will all find jobs and get recycled through. And their past experience is actually going to be super beneficial. And that will happen faster and faster, actually. So I think the stat, the last time I checked it, average tenure in the Valley is under 2 years. And partially that's failure, but partially that's like people finding better opportunities, all these sorts of things happening. And so I don't think people join startups with the expectation they're going to be there for 10 years.
I think that like I said, it's a learning cycle, especially for Singapore, right? Because Asia, you know, boom has probably been most rewarding for tech workers, I would say, in Singapore, Indonesia, and Vietnam. Nearly, I think Singapore, with technology, I think like true, this is the first big down cycle. I think Singapore experience since the technology kind of like kick off. Of like cultural learning, like you said, around failure / layoffs. And he saw that the shop back layoffs that he had was done, and you know, all over the news, it was on Reddit as well. And I was just chatting a little bit about it, you know, thinking that quite professionally well run. I thought the layoff, I thought a clear messaging. He apologized. He had a decent package that he had put together for the team.
I thought the package was really well done. It was like a Valley style package, actually, with like severance, acceleration of vesting, immigration support, job support. I think that stuff was all like compassionate and respectful.
It's in class in Singapore, probably, at least from what I've seen. I had the Lazada layoffs early in the year, and it was very much in alignment with the, you know, tripartite guidance for layoffs. This is like probably best in class, I'll say.
Yeah, I took a scan through the Reddit notes. I think there were a bunch of people who were like, why do you need so many people? Is my cashback at risk?
Question is cashback at risk? What if for me, buddy?
Yeah, I think there is that. But, you know, I think this is back to the earlier conversation, which is if you think you are on a really good growth path, you think you see opportunities to invest ahead to drive that. It is the rational thing, especially if your investors are funding. But I think it's also a very classical growth mistake. I think founders often underestimate the complexity of running multiple initiatives at the same time. And those things can get out of hand. And so I think he handled it in a pretty classy way. I think the package is good and hopeful that all those people will actually stick around and get recycled back through the ecosystem. Maybe they're going to start a new company. That'll actually be really great for the ecosystem.
Yeah, and I thought the way that they explained everything, they also talked about what was a business logic back in 2021 and 2022, right? So he said that, hey, we scaled our team from 550 people to over 900 shop backers, which is almost like 60% headcount increase. And then in Q2 2022, the market sentiment shifted. They tried to do a bunch of measures to avoid layoffs, but then stop hiring and try to do cost controls. But now, after the past effectively 1.5 years, they basically said, we got to do this layoff and cut. So I just felt like the whole rationale, I think the headline of the Straits Times obviously kind of described the layoff as every other layoff. But I feel like the corporate letter, the logic, and like you said, the package that they put together, including like pay for the notice period, a 1 month severance for every year of service, you get your bonus paid out. Even if you're a junior, you get cash, you get learning and development, you got your healthcare coverage extended, you got your career transition support. This is probably, I was just saying, best in class, I would say, in Singapore, maybe even Southeast Asia for layoffs. It's very Valley-esque, and it's expensive, actually, this process.
They're going to take a charge, right?
Yeah, you know.
There's going to be a big charge on this, but you know, your sort of pro forma forward-looking be a lot leaner.
Yeah, and I think it's not an easy piece for them. But I think also how he did it was he announced the whole thing, probably this exact same letter to the team, but then he also posted it publicly at the same time as well. So I think a lot of startups in Southeast Asia have learned that if you do it privately, the layoff is going to go public anyway. So you might as well just go public immediately and get the whole story in front of people. I thought that was a well-done sort of layoff. But I think it reminds me that I was recently on the Channel News Asia, I was on Talking Points to talk about layoffs, right? That was on live TV, and you know, it was kind of an interesting learning lesson for myself. But one of the interesting things that they talked about was like Singapore actually has the most pro-business layoff policy in terms of guidelines across Asia, right? So obviously Japan is on the other end of the scale by far, which is that you have to do multiple amounts of notice, pretty difficult to let go of people. Now, obviously, I think the argument they were having is that Thailand and Malaysia have stronger labor laws than Singapore on employment and layoff practices.
I think this is like the flexibility and dynamism of the economy question, which is like, I think we have to walk a balance and there's tension there, obviously. But if you took the extreme examples like Europe, right? In Europe, it's really hard to let someone go, which means that a result is that people don't hire. I think that can work if you're sort of running your sort of SMB or whatever it is, where it's very steady year to year, week to week. And then the contrast, I mean, the other extreme is like the US, right? So like the US has, hey, you know, we can ramp up and we can fire people. Although it's not totally true. In the US, there is the WARN Act. If you have over 50 employees, there's actually a bunch of legal requirements associated with the layoff. But I think if you sort of conceptually thought of those as two extremes, it's like, where do you want to live between those things? How do you want the laws to play for smaller companies? Do you want to create more flexibility so that people can innovate and try things? Or do you want stasis? Because not everything is going to be a gigantic, steady cash flow business, right? That's just kind of not. And I think a lot of the rhetoric that we have around building an innovation economy requires us to build that flexibility.
Yeah, I think the tricky part is what's the line, what's the spectrum that we have here? And obviously, I think the line that we have here is what is the business practice law around retrenchments and layoffs in the country, which defines legal versus illegal. I think there's one threshold. And then the other threshold is irresponsible versus responsible. And I think that's a much fuzzier subjective guideline. I think that's where I think there's a lot of public anger, I think I would say. So I think everyone's very clear, like we don't want illegal practices and we want legal practices. But then I think the line between responsible and irresponsible layoffs, that definition, it almost becomes like a moral judgment. Yeah, I would say so. Like, you know, would you, and our way of saying is a responsible layoff by management could come across as irresponsible to somebody who is not part of management. That's what we were saying.
Well, I mean, you have to meet the legal requirements, but it's also, it's a tough decision. So here, would you have rather they laid you off 6 months earlier?
Yeah, not everybody would want to hear that.
No. I mean, I'm so, or would you want them to like, try to keep fighting and figuring something out, and then the package wasn't as good because there's less money left. That's the reality of the situation, which is when you're like, can I afford to keep these people? Well, it kind of depends on how this month comes in or this quarter comes in, but I don't know what the answer to that's going to be. Should I lay them off now? But then I'm shooting myself in the foot because I'm not going to have enough staff if the growth comes in the way that I think. That's actually the conversation people are having. What is the sustainable version of my business? And you just don't have all the answers. And not everyone, I mean, ShopX raised a lot of money, right? Not everyone has so much cash cushion to like wait. And so I think there's this sort of, hey, it's actually a hard question. Then the second part is, I think this is where actually people screw up a lot, is that like, because people feel bad about the layoffs, they communicate it really awkwardly.
Yeah.
And they often try to like say this like official to try to make it feel like less awkward, but it actually makes it more awkward because you're like, hey man, like I'm a human, I work with you, like why are you saying weird corporate speak to me, right? So I think there's some of that, which is just if you don't treat people humanely and with compassion, then they will feel badly treated, separate from the legal requirements and separate from what package.
I think the crux of it is just that it's just layoffs are tough, right? Nobody wants to do it. I mean, everybody would rather hire and promote rather than lay off. So I think management are responsible and they should do it professionally. But I think labeling management layoffs as irresponsible is not the same. Right. So I think that's a fine nuance definition.
I mean, I could see someone is, well, you should have hired all those people because hiring all those people results in a situation where you had to fire.
Yeah.
Right. I think that's probably what people are thinking.
Yeah.
I mean, the flip side is what if we'd hired all those people and it actually supercharged growth and now your stock is worth way more and then you're happy, right? Like, we don't know. I think everything always looks a lot clearer in hindsight.
Yeah. I think not an easy situation. Well, hopefully good times come back. You know, everything's easy, but you know, the truth is it's not like that. And on that note, let's wrap things up. I think the three big takeaways we got was, first of all, we got to talk about TikTok, whether there's going to be a nationalization and divestment versus the exit of the US market and the electoral dynamics of it, but also what the alternatives to it in terms of regulation would be, but also obviously impacts executives and employment of the ByteDance folks. Secondly, I think we talked about Grab as a position, whether it's truly too big to fail. And our point of view is that too big to fail as a phrase primarily applies to financial institutions and that Grab is actually in a highly competitive, highly substitutable market that has finally turned a profit finally after subsidizing the ecosystem for a decade. And lastly, I think we've got to talk about the ShopX layoffs and how we think that there's obviously a lot of public debate and frustration around this, but we do think that from professional perspective, we do think that this is a Silicon Valley, probably best in class in the region type of layoff. And so hopefully the storm passes and everybody sails through at the other end of it. On that note, thanks so much and see you next time,
Shiyan. Thanks, Jeremy. Take it easy.
Thank you for listening to Brave. If you enjoyed this episode, please share the podcast with your friends and colleagues. We would also appreciate you leaving a rating or review. Head over to www.bravesea.com for member content, resources, and community. Stay well and stay brave.